Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from the Embassy Suites Hotel in Walnut Creek, California. I'm Bonnie Cox, Executive Director of the Commonwealth Club East Bay. We also welcome those joining us today on radio. Tonight's speaker is General Eugene Habiger, Director of the Security and Emergency Operations for the U.S. Department of Energy. And now it is my pleasure to invite Dr. Harold Smith to the podium to introduce tonight's speaker. Dr. Smith is a former assistant to the Secretary of Defense for Nuclear, Chemical, and Biological Programs under Secretaries Aspen, Perry, and Cohen, and a current distinguished visiting scholar at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Among other awards, Dr. Smith has three times received the Department of Defense highest honor for public service. Dr. Smith?
Thank you, Bonnie. It is a great pleasure to introduce my friend, fellow comrade from the Pentagon, General Eugene Habiger. Our paths have crossed many times when I was in office and in Gene's tour in the Pentagon and later. I want to give some insight into the caliber of the man who is speaking to you tonight. When General Habiger was Deputy Chief of Staff for Personnel, he did the Office of the Secretary of Defense enormous services by providing to us, particularly to me, the very best of the Air Force officers who would then serve dutifully in the long hours and the difficult times within the Office of the Secretary. Furthermore, he ensured that those young officers did not suffer for being out of the Air Force for those many months. It was a commendable piece of work for which I know all the secretaries that I served were truly grateful. He then went on to a job that has a smaller title, but awesome responsibilities. His title was simply, and occasionally he was referred to fondly, as SINC-STRAT. That stands for Commander-in-Chief Strategic Command, and his responsibilities included all the planning for all things involving our enormous nuclear arsenal. He did a splendid job, and I had to work with him quite often, and I can say that with great personal knowledge. Let me give you some further insight. While SINC-STRAT, General Habiger befriended his counterpart in Russia, General Igor Sergeyev, who is now the Minister of Defense of Russia. And in that capacity, a bond of trust grew up to the point where General Sergeyev invited General Habiger to come to Russia and to actually tour and inspect one of their nuclear bases, a so-called alert base, where the missiles and the bombers are ready to go. No American, to my knowledge, in the government or outside, has had that honor. And General Habiger's letters to the Secretary, which I received copies, were truly wonderful insights into what was good and what was not so good about the situation in Russia. I'll let the General speak for himself if he chooses on that issue, but he did the country a great service in arranging to be invited to tour that alert base. A little background. General Habiger rose from a private in the United States Army to a four-star general in the United States Air Force. Now, to be honest, it took him well over 30 years to do that, but he did it. He has flown 5,000 hours of mostly bombers. To put that in perspective, I, too, have flown many hours, usually in United Airlines. But 5,000 hours is about 2.5 million miles. I've flown well over a million miles, usually in economy, somewhat stressful. But, of course, it doesn't compare with 5,000 hours, mostly in a B-52, which is far worse than United Economy Class. Most of all, he has flown 150 combat missions. This is a man who has earned the thanks of his country in uniform, and he has gracefully decided to return to serving his country. This is not a surprise to me, but it's fortunate for all of us. General Habergood.
Well, thank you very much, Harold. That was a very warm, gracious introduction. And thank you all for affording me this opportunity to talk to you a little bit tonight about the Department of Energy and our national security responsibilities as they relate to the security and protection of our critical assets involving nuclear weapons and nuclear material. And especially given the history of your organization dating back to the turn of the century and the impressive list of distinguished speakers that this group has entertained, I am both humbled and honored of the opportunity to speak with you. I'm also appreciative of the opportunity to come back to Northern California. It's always a special treat to come back to this area since I grew up and went to high school in Oakland. During the spring of this year, I, like many of you, had been following the stories in the media regarding espionage activities directed at our national laboratories and security lapses at the Department of Energy. I followed these reports with equal interest and alarm. As a former commander-in-chief, as Dr. Smith pointed out, of the United States Strategic Command, I was intimately familiar with the national security responsibility of the Department of Energy as they relate to the nation's nuclear weapons program. On the 16th of June, my interest became even more acute as this was the day Secretary Richardson asked me to become the Department of Energy's security czar. I had never met the secretary before, but I will tell you, he's a most impressive, dynamic individual. Since my arrival in the department, I have visited all of our department's major sites, reviewed virtually all of our security plans, observed and participated in segments of our protective force training, examined our newly implemented cybersecurity procedures at our national laboratories, talked to hundreds of scientists and technicians, and I've taken and passed a polygraph examination. First, it is clearly obvious that the department reacted appropriately to the wake-up call received this past year with the uncovering of internal security problems and the publication of both the Cox and the Rudman reports. Second, security throughout the department is being administered responsibly and conscientiously by dedicated, hardworking professionals who are firmly committed to protecting the national security assets which are entrusted to them. Finally, although we do have security issues which we must and will address, I found that all of our sites that I have visited have the foundation to perform their security functions capably given adequate resources. But I also discovered several troubling issues. First and foremost, it was apparent to me early on that the department was extremely close to losing the confidence and special trust of both the American people and the Congress with respect to our ability to perform our security requirements. The enormous media coverage surrounding recent security-related events, coupled with the DOE's historical track record of security deficiencies, added to this erosion. Secondly, and equally as important, I discovered that over the years, the department unfortunately had lost its focus on security. The Secretary on numerous occasions has referred to the department as being a group of fiefdoms within fiefdoms. And almost every fiefdom had its own security responsibility and its own security budget. There was no office or individual within the department who had the ultimate accountability for the critical security requirements for which DOE is responsible, nor was there any individual responsibility and accountability for their acts. Byproducts of this organizational dysfunction and the lack of focus included a deterioration of security awareness and education, resulting in a failure to remind and educate our employees and contractors as to their personal security responsibilities and accountabilities. A lack of attention to our cybersecurity practices in a world of increased computer hacking and cyber terrorism, and a gradual erosion of resources required to improve our capabilities to combat ever-changing terrorist and cyber terrorist threats. And finally, and most significantly, Congress has, up to this point, failed to fund the department's fiscal year 2000 budget amendment in order for us to make most necessary long and near-term fixes. We have valid requirements in the area of cybersecurity to buy hardware, encryption equipment, and to train our systems administrators. We need to equip our protective forces to combat weapons of mass destruction, and we need program direction funds to stand up a rigorous foreign visitors access program, as well as an acceptable plutonium, uranium, and special nuclear materials control and accountability program. Simply stated, ladies and gentlemen, we have been given a mandate, but not the resources to accomplish that mandate. So why would anyone take this job? Well, essentially, I had two reasons. First, I firmly believe that something had to be done. And second, I love a challenge. Soon after coming on board, I put in motion an aggressive four-phase security campaign. And being an ex-military guy, you would expect a campaign, right? In phase one, which was completed in August, I initiated visits to each of the major DOE sites and established a baseline from which to move forward. Areas requiring immediate fixes were identified. During this period, a complex-wide security stand-down was conducted to promote security awareness as an individual responsibility. New policy was issued for foreign visitors to ensure that the tightest possible security procedures were followed. In phase two, currently underway, I completed visits to the sites and issued, or I'm in the process of issuing, policy addressing key issues such as standardized weapons for our protective forces and the requirement for our protective forces to keep around in the chamber under their weapons while carried on duty. We now have policies that mandate the timely reporting of security incidents, the use of warning banners on computer systems, and badge validation procedures. We are developing an integrated security awareness training curriculum. Further, two very similar personal security assurance programs will be combined into a single departmental human reliability program to eliminate redundancy and streamline the administrative process. In the area of cybersecurity, the national laboratories have implemented numerous corrective actions. Key among these is a program to achieve physical incompatibility between removable media formats within common laboratory work areas. We are taking this sweeping action in an effort to prevent the intentional or inadvertent transfer of classified information from classified to unclassified systems or to a media format easily concealed and removed. In related efforts, the laboratories will continue to search unclassified archives and to monitor outgoing email messages for classified contact. Ladies and gentlemen, at each of our three nuclear weapons laboratories, we have approximately 250 emails a day being generated. That's 750,000 emails a day at each or throughout our complex. That's a lot of email and perhaps puts into perspective the new environment in which we are living today. We are also developing a comprehensive set of metrics to make sure we are making continuous improvements. Phase three will occur of January to March of next year, at which time most new policies to fix security will have been implemented. I will revisit the field to evaluate the effectiveness of these policies and to define metrics for use for future assessments. At this stage, most of the major security concerns will be fixed. Let me repeat that. At this stage, most of the major security concerns will be fixed and the focus turn to improvements and enhancements. When we reach phase four in April to September of next year, proposed fixes will be in place and our efforts turn toward adjustments as we maintain a world-class security program. A critical activity here will be continuous feedback from the field, scheduled visits to the field, and regularly held meetings with representatives from all sites to exchange lessons learned and best practices. As a key player in the protection of our nation's national and economic security, the Department of Energy has profound protection responsibilities. These responsibilities are mission essential elements of this department that must and will be integrated into all aspects of what we do. Essentially, there are six of these responsibilities. First, national nuclear security. This involves protecting the nation's special nuclear materials inventory. Here I'm talking about plutonium and highly enriched uranium. The nuclear weapons in the department's custody and our unique research and technical capabilities. Equally critical is our charge to protect classified and other sensitive information as it pertains to nuclear weapons design. This responsibility is particularly crucial in the area of cybersecurity and our ability to protect information stored and processed in our computer systems. Second, counterterrorism. DOE facilities are potentially attractive targets for terrorists because of the obvious and significant publicity and attention such event would receive. The volatility of global and domestic terrorism compels a cooperative and responsive interorganizational security structure. Third, emergency management. The department provides emergency response capability to assist in the response to nuclear and radiological emergencies within the United States and abroad. For example, the department is sending a team of U.S. nuclear experts to Japan to exchange information with their Japanese counterparts on the criticality incident which occurred recently at one of their uranium processing facilities. These Department of Energy experts will help the Japanese people and the international scientific community better understand why the accident happened. In addition, they will also analyze the procedures and processes used in response to the incident. Last month, for example, the department received a request from the U.S. ambassador in Cambodia for technical support regarding a radiological issue. As a result, a special team was quickly dispatched to conduct a specific survey. The mission was extremely successful, and the ambassador and the Cambodian government were especially grateful for what we did in such a quick and thorough response effort. Fourth, counterproliferation. The Department of Energy has technical expertise to counter the proliferation of domestic materials and information that can be used in the construction of weapons of mass destruction. Fifth, energy infrastructure protection. As a designated lead agency by a presidential decision directive, the department, in addition to protecting the critical assets entrusted to our care as a federal agency, we must assist the private sector in the protection of the nation's energy infrastructure through a dynamic sharing of information and expertise throughout the entire government. And finally, technological leadership. We must maintain technological preeminence that will ensure the department is able to protect its assets, contribute to other domestic security programs, and leverage expertise into international security initiatives. In implementing this responsibility, we must create options and provide alternatives that allow for the mitigation of capabilities, expertise, and enhance resource use across governmental agencies. We cannot and should not operate in a vacuum. Our approach should be in consonance with our partners at the federal, state, and local levels. And I want you to know, when I took the job, I thought I was just going to have to worry about security at our laboratories. But as you can see, it's much more than that. Each of these six responsibilities is critical in their own right. Operating at or just below the surface of these responsibilities, however, are a series of challenges that we must meet if we are to satisfy our responsibilities and be truly successful in sustaining a comprehensive protection program, which is absolutely second to none. The first involves the intermediate-term storage of special nuclear material. Present and future security planning is dependent on plans and activities to store and regulate the nation's nuclear weapons stockpile and special nuclear material inventory. Some materials consolidation has taken place, but I will tell you we have a long way to go. Significant quantities of special nuclear material remain in aging buildings and structures ranging from 12 to 50 years old. Many of these were never intended for use as storage facilities for extended periods. These facilities are costly to maintain and require extensive protective measures. And I would quickly point out at this point that the materials are safe and they're secure. It's just we're having to spend exorbitant amounts of money and resources and manpower to make sure they are safe and secure. The responsibilities for consolidation and storage are very substantial, as the department has stewardships over hundreds of metric tons of nuclear weapons-grade material. Another challenge involves classified information protection. The reliability and security of the nation's nuclear deterrent depends on uncompromised protection of its sensitive and classified technical capabilities and information. The threat to information managed within the cyber dimension mirrors that faced by other agencies and the private sector. Based on current information and as forecast into the future, the theft or diversion of sensitive information and technology will continue to be one of our most serious threats. An integral part of our information protection responsibilities is our ability to counter the threat to our automated information systems. No other concern challenges today's security environment more than the threat posed to information in the ever-changing electronic realm of cyberspace. Throughout the department, and indeed the federal government, the use of networks for the processing of classified and unclassified information is growing every day. Similarly, use of the Internet for both technical and administrative needs is increasing at an exponential rate. These factors have resulted in an increased vulnerability of systems and the need for a comprehensive approach to system security. Resource commitment, technical sharing, and cooperative interaction must be exercised to effectively counter this complicated and immense threat. Yet another challenge we face involves the development of innovative technology applications. Effective security technologies are key to cost-effective implementation of the department's present and future protection strategies and special nuclear material storage and processing. These technologies are also crucial to the successful support of national nuclear nonproliferation, treaty verification, and counterterrorism strategies, particularly relating protection against weapons of mass destruction. Today's global technology is expanding at an extremely rapid pace, placing continued demands on the departments to sustain an active security technology development and application effort. As critical as all these challenges are, however, confronting them will be doomed for failure unless we can instill a sense of responsibility and ownership by the rank and file that comprise the Department of Energy. From the Secretary of Energy to the entry-level employee, to all levels of contractor and laboratory employees, each and every individual must be aware of the respective responsibilities when it comes to protecting national security assets entrusted to their care, and ultimately be held responsible if he or she were to somehow violate that trust. Successful implementation of security responsibilities will depend on a focused and well-defined management structure that addresses policy and decision-making, personnel and budget resources, planning and programming execution. As the first step, we must reconstitute available resources into a robust, responsive, and unified security organization. This was the Secretary's intent when he established the organization I now head. We are making real progress, and in my view, we have turned the corner. But I will also tell you we're getting a lot of help from Congress in terms of a mandated reorganization that must be in place by March of next year. Second, our workforce is the most critical link in the chain of protection of our security interests. Consequently, we are instilling a sense of urgency and corporate ownership among all DOE employees, not just those that have security in their job description. This can be accomplished through a meaningful enforcement program that holds individuals accountable should they violate their security responsibilities. And in this regard, we have issued a zero-tolerance security policy for those that violate security policies and procedures. Since the termination of nuclear weapons production, the department's focus on security has steadily waned as emphasis moved toward non-defense-related programs. The result has been a lackadaisical approach to security. This attitude is changing as we endeavor on a daily basis to instill a sense of ownership among all employees at all levels. Third, to change this attitude, we must enforce our efforts to ensure that employees are fully aware of their own responsibilities. The granting of a security clearance carries with it a very serious obligation to protect the sensitive and critical assets entrusted to one's care. Therefore, we are mounting an aggressive and comprehensive security education and awareness program to remind each and every individual of their obligations. Finally, we are recognizing and fully supporting our role in the national security community by institutionalizing my office as the focal point for the department in interagency partnerships. In doing so, we actively contribute to the protection of the nation's private industry, energy infrastructure. Essentially, there are three things that I hope to accomplish as the individual the Secretary is called upon to implement the Department's protection responsibilities. I call them ingrain, sustain, and regain. First, we must ingrain into the work ethic of all departmental employees the security responsibilities inherent in everything we do, to the point where security becomes second nature for what they do day in and day out. Second, we must sustain the level of excellence we have created with respect to our protection responsibilities. And if we are successful, and I'm confident that we will be, in achieving these two objectives, we will regain that special trust of the American people and the American Congress. So if there's one message I would like for you to take with you tonight, it is that we at the Department of Energy take our responsibilities to the American people for the protection of national security assets very, very seriously. The trust that you have placed in our ability to protect these most sensitive resources is immense. This trust cannot and will not be violated. Today, the Department of Energy functions in a security environment decidedly different from the one we faced a decade ago. There is growing concern about a new breed of threats that confront the department and the nation's security structures. Terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, and cyber attacks have become ingrained into the global psyche and our nation's security consciousness. These non-traditional, multi-directional threats are testing security resolve and capabilities as never before. It's obvious we cannot control or alter the threats to the security interests entrusted to our care. What can be controlled, however, is our ability to plan and respond to threats should they ever materialize. The changing security environment and other threats over the past decade have fundamentally altered the department's security perspective and posture. This is a significant challenge, but one that we are prepared to meet. You, the American public, rightfully expect us to, and we expect no less from ourselves. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you, General Habegger, Director of Security and Emergency Operations for the United States Department of Energy, for your remarks here today. We have a large number of questions, so let us begin. Sir, are you concerned about morale at the nuclear research laboratories? Is there an atmosphere there that's more Big Brother-like than ever? And what is the effect on productivity?
That's an excellent question, and I've had the opportunity in the past, in the 60-day period between the 1st of July and the end of August, to visit our national labs on numerous occasions. I went out most recently as part of the public hearings on polygraphs. And this is this whole issue of the Big Brother of increased security is a concern, on morale, productivity, our ability to recruit the best and the brightest. And I would be the first to admit that our nuclear weapons program demands nothing less than the best and the brightest, is something that is we're all sensitive to with in the department in terms of those who are in senior positions. Secretary Richardson is very sensitive to this particular aspect. Unfortunately, we've had a wake-up call, as I pointed out in my discussion, my talk. The American public will expect nothing less than perfection, and we are moving down a path of not so much risk management, but risk avoidance. Think about that. Risk avoidance is nothing's going to happen. Risk management is you're going to mitigate as best you can. Once you lose a nuclear secret, you can never get it back. I've learned that just talking to the scientists. There is concern. It is not going to be a Big Brother kind of operation. We have to change the culture of the scientists and the technicians and the everyone else in the department. 10 years ago, the culture regarding safety within the department was about the same way as it is now for security. And through a lot of hard work by a lot of people, we've changed that culture regarding to safety. So that now when a Department of Energy employee goes into a room or an office or a laboratory and there's, a bare electrical wire, well, that operation in that laboratory is going to be shut down until someone comes and fixes the wire. Well, if any of you have read the Rudman report, you know, there's a page in that report which is a disgrace. It talks about locks on safes and locks going into on doors, going into buildings where classified materials were. They were going for tens of days, tens of weeks, in some cases 10 months before they were being fixed. That's a cultural problem. People at our laboratories, at every site, if they go into a room where a safe is not operating properly, a security system is not operating properly, they ought to take the same approach as if it was a bare wire and have it fixed immediately or have the classified material moved until that particular issue can be fixed. That's how we need the big thing we need to do in terms of turning the culture around. Not an easy problem, and I kind of relate to it in terms of packaging a new brand of cereal. You know, it's not very exciting cereal, but it's something that we need, and so we need to repackage security so it becomes a way of life just like safety is.
General Habegger, your view on how the news media has covered security and espionage issues.
Another good question. This is a big story. The American people have a right, obviously, to know about what's happening in our nation's most precious of jewels, our nuclear secrets. And there was, as I point out in my talk, an enormous amount of coverage because this is a big story. And I would submit over the coming months, if something pops up, especially between now and the time of elections, you're going to see big headlines. And let me point out for those of you here tonight that I have no political dog in this hunt. None, zero. I am apolitical. There's only one person in the world that knows my true political bent, and that's my wife. And unfortunately, we cancel each other out every time we vote.
General Habegger, what is the propriety of giving lie detector tests, and how much trust do you place in these tests?
The priority?
Propriety was what I tried
to
say.
Thank you. Polygraph tests are not perfect. Scientists who work in our nuclear labs are smart. They're scientists. Many of them are PhDs. They're world class. They work in a pretty much binary world. It's either 100% right or don't bother me with it. And I'll be the first to admit that polygraphs are not perfect, but they're the best we have. And the other perspective I would throw at you is the polygraph test given by the Department of Energy, ladies and gentlemen, has four questions. Four questions. Question number one, have you ever committed espionage? Question number two, have you ever committed sabotage? Question number three, have you ever knowingly given secrets to a foreign national? Question number four, have you ever had an authorized contact with a foreign national? Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know if I can put it any simpler, but if we have people in our national laboratories working on our most sensitive secrets who can't answer those four questions, maybe they ought to go do something else.
General Haviger, what impact do you think Y2K will have on your job? And a second question related, are you worried about Y2K?
Well, that's another thing that they didn't tell me about when I took the job, that I was going to be responsible for Y2K kinds of things. I can stand here and report that within the Department of Energy, we're there. We're Y2K compliant with our security systems and everything associated with our laboratories. In addition to all the protection things we talked about, I also have operations and emergency response. So while most of you will be spending the new millennium with your spouse or significant other, I will be in our underground command post in Washington, D.C., beginning when the First Nation undergoes Y2K, which is New Zealand, and I will remain there until the last country on the west coast of South America goes through Y2K. That's part of my job description. You know, security czar, Y2K czar, I will be there along with a lot of other folks. Am I concerned? Not about the United States. I have great confidence that we're in good shape. My sensitivity, though, is perhaps an overreaction by the American public. The media today has enormous capability to bring to the TV screen, CNN's a classic example, information near real time. And my sensitivity is that CNN will report a hiccup somewhere and it'll get it blown out of proportion. Then you'll see an overreaction by the people here in the United States. By the same token, the other concern I have is an unusual weather event like a nor'easter going up the east coast of the United States, dropping 2 or 3 inches of ice and power lines going down and that sort of thing. And then that during this period of the Y2K period and people overreacting to that. I'm confident. I've seen when I was at the Command in Chief of the United States Strategic Command, we started looking at this issue back in 1997. And Department of and I was very confident what we were doing there, and I'm equally confident what we're doing in Department of Energy and across the infrastructure, the energy infrastructure that I'm associated with in terms of fossil fuels and electrical energy.
Any concerns about a terrorist attack that might be
associated with this? The question was, any concerns about a terrorist attack during that time frame? Yes, that is something that is of concern. I will tell you that and this is something that's not new since coming into this job. I've done a lot of thinking about terrorism, international terrorism, and I'm convinced that it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And so we really need to keep pay attention to this area.
Continuing on the Y2K problem, can you comment on the situation with Y2K in Russia? Perhaps taking advantage of your good relationship with General Sergeyev?
Another good question. I first started discussing this with Russian senior leadership in the spring of 1998. As I recall, it was in February 98 in Moscow, and had follow-up discussions in March and again in June. The Russians have gone to great lengths to to mitigate any Y2K problems. They assured me in June of 1998 that they had identified or fixed the problems that were of concern to them. I believe it's a major step forward in terms of an initiative that Secretary Cohn has established, whereby Russian officers will be in our command center at Cheyenne Mountain, where we generate data information on our early ballistic missile early warning system. It'll be a relatively short period of time. It's not more than a week or two where we'll be doing this. But I think, number one, it's a great opportunity to make sure that everything's under control during this transition period as we enter the new millennium. But also, and equally important, it's a very important first step for initiatives that hopefully we'll see in the future with increased cooperation with the Russians.
It would appear from the media that the administration and the Congress are on a collision course with regard to a semi-autonomous agency. Can you comment on how this collision, whether this collision course will come about and how it could be avoided?
I wouldn't call it a collision course. I wouldn't call it a train wreck. Congress has passed a law, and we're going to abide by the law. Is it going to be fun? No, but we're going to do it. That's what a democracy is all about. You may not necessarily agree with what Congress mandates, but when they pass a law, you move out very smartly and comply with the law, and that's what we're going to do.
Are the security leaks due to lack of enforcement of existing measures or lack of security measures?
Let me answer it this way. We fell into a sense of complacency. We hadn't really paid much attention to an insider threat. And I need to be very careful because I need to be skating very fast here because I'm on thin ice. But I don't want to make any assertions that would direct my comments to any particular case. I'll be in very, very general terms here. But if you look at an insider threat, someone who's a loyal and trusted employee, and then you have indications that maybe that loyal and trusted employee is doing malicious things, either with computers or equipment, that's pretty tough to mitigate against. But as I pointed out earlier, we were walking down a path not of risk management, but of risk avoidance. And we are going to extreme lengths to make sure that insiders cannot download something on a floppy disk, something classified, and then walk out with it. And we're not alone. I mean, this applies to Department of Defense, Department of Agriculture, lots of departments out there that have the same problem. So it's a problem that is being faced throughout the government, not necessarily just the Department of Energy.
Non-U.S. citizens represent a substantial portion of the U.S. and international science and technology base. How can our national security laboratories, our weapon laboratories, best take advantage of this key resource while protecting sensitive information?
Ladies and gentlemen, 51% of the PhD students in the United States today in the basic sciences, chemistry, physics, mathematics, are foreign nationals. 51%. That is not a bad deal. But what that goes to show you is that, and I'm not a scientist, don't profess to be one, but I will tell you that I've learned in the past 4 or 5 months that I've been in this job that the key to successful research is an open dialogue between scientists, no matter what their nationality. And we are going to great lengths to make sure that that dialogue continues. But by the same token, we are taking some very aggressive actions to make sure that when foreign nationals visit one of our national laboratories, our national nuclear laboratories, I'm talking about Livermore, Los Alamos, and Sandia, that the proper controls, the proper security clearances, plans, the proper security checks are made to ensure that we don't do anything dumb when it comes to foreign nationals visiting our highly sensitive laboratories. This afternoon, I just was over at the Stanford's Linear Accelerator Center there, and spent an afternoon with the director, Dr. Jonathan Dorfman. And we talked at length about this particular problem, and I'm very sensitive to a complete and open a dialogue between scientists, and we will take the appropriate actions to make sure that that dialogue continues, but by the same token, we're going to make sure that we don't do anything dumb.
Is the great email usage business-related or personal use on government time?
It is government use. We have, just like any, there's a government-wide standard that says, just like the use of the telephone, there's nothing to prohibit you from picking up the phone and calling home to check and see if, you know, the lost dog or cat's been found or if anything needs to be picked up. Of course, you don't pick up the phone and call your wife in Moscow to see how things are going on, let the government pay for it. And we use the same kind of common sense when it comes to email. The, you know, 99%, 98% are government-related. Maybe it's a little less than that. But we have done something to ensure that when you go and operate your computer, there's a warning banner that I reference in my talk that comes up that says your computer can be examined for improper usage, and your email can be monitored. And we have two individuals at each of our national laboratories who are dedicated full-time to read email. Is that an invasion of privacy? Not if you're working in one of our national laboratories. I didn't find this out until I got in the job, but, you log on the computer and let's say you go to some websites. Well, even though you go off the website, and I'm not saying what website one would go to, but there are folks who have the expertise and equipment to go into a hard drive and find out where you've been 4 years ago, assuming you have the same computer. I've never had that problem, trust me, but we have found people from time to time that have gone to websites that were not appropriate, and we've taken the appropriate action.
How did we come to this situation? Why was this not identified and corrected 20 years ago? Where were you, Gene, when we needed you?
Twenty years ago is a different threat. I mean, if you were to go back and look at the last time we had any serious leaks in our nuclear program, you'd go back to the 50s. And, ladies and gentlemen, if you were to go back and do the math, and I've kind of done it in the back of an envelope, and looked at the hundreds of thousands of people that worked in the Department of Energy from the period, say, 1955 until today, you'd probably see 2 million people. I'm talking about, people that worked and then retired and new people came on, or people that worked and then left for another job. And the number of security incidents, you can, you put it on less than two hands. But we've had a major, major wake-up call of almost unprecedented significance since the early 50s. And we, the American people, have reacted. The American Congress have reacted appropriately, I think. And we in the Department of Energy are reacting appropriately, in my view, and very aggressively. It's just something you don't pay much attention to. It's like having one of your children come home and steal the silver. Do you expect that to happen? No.
Can you comment on the reaction to espionage against the laboratories? Is it on the rise throughout the important parts of the world with regard to nuclear weapons?
One more time.
Can you comment on the reaction to espionage? In fact, in light of the fact that all the major players in the political world are actively involved in espionage, or so the questioner says.
I would disagree with the premise that all the major players are engaged in espionage. There's certainly interest amongst our nuclear weapons designers on they're a very inquisitive group, by the way, and a very strange group. I have a great deal of respect for them, but any nuclear weapons designer in the audience here? There's one. He's not smiling too much, so two, and he's smiling. or is that a grimace, sir? A very unusual group, a very perfectionist-type group, and they're very interested in how other countries are solving the riddles of nuclear weapons design. It is, and without going into a lot of detail, what I've learned, and I think the two designers here in the audience would agree, nuclear weapons design is more of an art than it is a science.
Minister Adamov and Minister Mikhailov have both commented quite publicly on the need for Russia to develop new tactical nuclear weapons, and I stress new. Can you comment on this subject?
I will comment in terms of my own personal professional view rather than associated with the position I'm in now. If the Russians pursue a new tactical weapon, it's going to be an interesting dilemma for them because they've agreed, at least to the concept of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, that there would be no further nuclear testing. So if they fielded a nuclear weapon, it would be unprecedented because it would be untested. And nuclear weapons designers, as we pointed out, are a demanding group, and that's why the United States is investing, we as taxpayers, about $4.5 billion a year to mitigate the lack of underground testing. This $4.5 billion a year over a 10-year period, that's $45 billion, is being spent to ensure we have scientific methods to ensure the status of our nuclear weapons stockpile without testing. So that would be an unusual step for them. But I also recognize that the Russians have significant problems in the combat readiness of their conventional forces. The last data point I had is about a year old, but as of last summer, the Russians were going to extreme lengths to ensure that their nuclear forces were being paid in a timely manner as perhaps compared to other conventional forces.
Are the Russians better or worse than we with regard to counter-espionage?
Tough question, and I cannot give you a good answer because I really haven't talked to them about this particular subject, and hopefully in the coming months I will have the opportunity. I have certainly compared notes with them in our security procedures, physical security procedures, at our nuclear weapons storage sites, but we haven't talked about counter-espionage. I will tell you that the Department of Energy hired about 18 months ago an individual named Ed Kearns, who's detailed to the Department of Energy from the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Mr. Kearns is in charge of our counterintelligence program, our counter-espionage program. Ed was the guy who turned CIA around after the Ames event. So if anybody can turn the Department of Energy around and make significant progress when it comes to counterintelligence or espionage, it's Ed Kearns.
What would be your advice to the next president regarding resubmission of the comprehensive test ban?
Absolutely, unequivocally, the right thing to do. I was very disappointed that the treaty was voted down. It's something that's good for the world. It's good for the United States. And hopefully after the proper level of debate and discussion, they will get on with this and do what's right.
This is not an easy job. Given your responsibilities to protect America's nuclear secrets, how do you plan to overcome the allegedly arrogant attitude of the UC labs towards DOE oversight and control?
I've never met an arrogant UC lab scientist. That was something that came up in the Rudman report, arrogant attitude by the scientists' laboratories. Ladies and gentlemen, I do not doubt that, but by the same token, I cannot confirm that. We have literally tens of hundreds of very dedicated professional scientists who work at our laboratories, who are world-class, they're national assets, and we ought to treat them that way, and I propose to treat them exactly that way.
As an expert on nuclear weapons and their proliferation, how likely do you believe it is that we will see a nuclear weapon used in anger in the next millennium?
Could you keep it a little smaller, maybe in the first century of the next millennium? That's what you call long-range planning. I think the odds are much higher for a terrorist nuclear device being used as compared to a nuclear device being a nuclear weapon being used by in anger from one country against another. The concern I have is proliferation. If 500 years from now we have two-thirds of the countries on the planet with nuclear weapons, that's going to be a very serious world. But then I put it in perspective of the chemical and biological weapons. Those are more proliferant than nuclear weapons, and we certainly haven't seen them being used since the gory lessons of World War I.
Unfortunately, we have time for just one more question. How concerned should Americans be about terrorist attacks on the nuclear labs? What are the best and worst case scenarios, and how can we be prepared in each case?
Our laboratories are protected by a professional force of protective officers. We call them security police officers. They're civilians. They're authorized the use of deadly force. We've supplied them with the best equipment that money can buy, the best weapons that money can buy. We go through an extraordinary validation process to make sure the plans are valid in terms of countering a terrorist threat, a terrorist attack. I've also reviewed in depth the plans at most of our facilities and the threat that we pose. In other words, what kind of terrorist attack can you expect? I will tell you that that threat that we've postulated is a very robust threat. And so we've structured our people and our equipment and our technology against a threat that is of very, very high order of magnitude, equal to our very elite Special Forces troops.
Our thanks to General Eugene Habiger, Director of Security and Emergency Operations for the Department of Energy, for joining us today. We also thank our audience here in Walnut Creek, as well as those listening on radio. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.
The swing of gavel. Yeah.